financial planning, and security can sometimes be seen as a moving target. The rules change constantly, and you need guidance to stay ahead of the market moves. This is the Labenthal Report with Michael Hartzman and Dominic Tavella. We'll break down the news, trends, and overall direction of the markets, telling you what may be coming next, investment opportunities, and what to avoid. Now, here are your hosts, Dominic Tavella and Michael Hartzman.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman. Today is Tuesday, May 10th, 2022, and I'm on, as always, with my partner, Dominic Tavella. How are you, Dom?
Doing well, Mike, doing well. A lot better, I think, than the markets and the economy, but that's still to be determined. But on a personal level, doing well, no complaints.
Good, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, we do have a lot to talk about tonight, Dominic. We decided to go it alone, not to have a guest, because there's no shortage of topics. I don't think we'll run out of steam this evening at all.
But and I think, Mike, an opportunity for us to be the voice of reason. I think sometimes people just looking at the headlines and the volatility, they're likely going to create a scenario of making rash decisions, and maybe we can be the voice of reason tonight.
Well, I hope so. And to that point, you know, last week, other than Wednesday, when the Feds came out and Jerome Powell said raising interest rates 0.75 is off the table, and the market reacted very favorably to that. Last week seemed like a disaster by the time the week was over. But, you know, the S&P was barely down last week. The Dow was barely down last week, and the NASDAQ was only down 1.5%. But I have to tell you something, by Friday afternoon, I was exhausted. It just felt way worse than that.
We always use the analogy I do of a roller coaster ride and the ups and downs, and all that ends up happening is you end up where you started, but you're a little nauseous. That's the definition of what happened last week. If you closed your eyes on Monday and opened up on Friday, you go, nothing happened. The S&P was virtually unchanged. But the volatility in the meantime, the 1,000 points up, the 1,000 points down, my God, if you didn't get nauseous, you weren't really paying attention.
You know, and we did our morning call this morning, like we do every Tuesday with our advisors. And, you know, you made the comment that yesterday kind of felt like a washout. And you said yesterday really felt like maybe we were reaching for a bottom, or although the market was only down 600 points, you felt that there was a lot of selling yesterday. But one way or the other, Dom, you know, the NASDAQ is still down 22%. So welcome to the bear territory, and the S&P is down 15. So yeah, it's been a rocky road, but the numbers year to date are not pretty, no matter how you look at it.
No, Mike, and I always think that the headlines sometimes are deceiving. Both the S&P numbers and the NASDAQ numbers are down substantially year to date. But when you dig a little bit deeper, I know we've touched on this in prior shows. I actually did for a little homework. I did a study of how many stocks were down over 50%. And honestly, I stopped counting because at that point it didn't matter anymore. But you look at some of these companies out there, last year's high flyers, last year must own, and these names are down 60, 70, 80%. That's pain. That's pain. You can recover from a 15% loss in a good quality company. It'll come back, or market will recover. The economy will recover. But when you've lost 60, 80% of your money, the odds of getting that money back are pretty far-fetched, pretty difficult.
You know, thankfully, for a lot of reasons, we hardly ever talk about the pandemic or COVID anymore. And some of the stocks, Dom, you're referring to, are a lot of those lockdown stocks, work at home, exercise at home, whether it's Zoom or Peloton or even PayPal, where people were, you know, shopping online. Those stocks, to your point, have been decimated.
So I know, and again, we tend to run much more conservative. I love to call them boring portfolios. So we're not down 15%, but you know, whatever you're down year to date, that's painful for us. But my God, pain is really out there. And we've for the most part, have been able to avoid it. But that to me is a horrific scenario, right? And that is going on. These companies that are just not making money, their growth prospects don't look anywhere near as positive. They've been punished. And I don't know when and if they'll ever recover.
You know, another company I left out is Netflix. And you know, and I don't consider Netflix a stay-at-home company because she's so, you know, people come home from work. And I still think they stream TV more than they watch network TV. But the competition now between, you know, Paramount and Hulu and Disney, it's just such a crowded marketplace.
That's a name,
now.
Mike, right? Disney. I mean, I think the stock is down over 30%. And you think of that as just one of these boring conservative companies. But again, their streaming business is not doing as well as they had hoped. And the cost of operating their parks, it's all about the economy. It's all about companies being able to make money.
So, Don, we have a lot to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about the bond market. We have to talk about the bond market. That has not been pretty either. We have to talk about I-bonds, getting a lot of calls about those. You know, we'll talk about headline risk a little bit and how people react.
Tomorrow's inflation number. We have a lot of things to kind of explain to our clients and our viewers what we think is going to happen and why. And hopefully we do it in a way that voice of reason.
Well, we're going to give it a shot and we'll be right back right after this break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Are you paying federal taxes on your cash? I work hard for my money that I keep in cash. And for the life of me, I can't imagine why anyone would want to pay federal taxes on their cash. That's why I keep my cash in the Lebenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. Symbol LEGAX. The tax.
Rates on cash are already so low, why pay federal taxes on the interest your cash earns? Remember, it's not what you earn, it's what you keep. The Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund, LETAX, may help you earn more on the cash you've worked hard for and keep more after-tax dollars in your pocket. Find out more about the fund by speaking with a Labenthal Global Advisors private wealth advisor or its sponsor, at dcmadvisors.com.
For your hard-earned cash, why pay the tax when there's the tax?
Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. It's not what you make, it's what you keep.
Before investing, you should carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information is in the prospectus, a copy of which may be obtained by calling 800-441-7031. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. There is no guarantee that this or any investing strategy will be successful. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. The fund is distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC, member FINRA. The fund may invest in municipal securities, the interest on which may be subject to federal alternative minimum tax. After the fund buys a security, the IRS may determine that a bond issued as tax-exempt should in fact be taxable. There is no affiliation between DCM Advisors, LLC, and Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC. DCM Advisors and Ultimus Fund Distributors are not affiliated with Labenthal Financial Services, Inc., or Labenthal Global Advisors, LLC.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to the Labenthal Report. If you're listening to the show live, join in on our discussion with questions or comments at 1-866-472-5790. Again, that's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to contact@labenthal.com. Now, back to the Labenthal Report.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman, back at always, as always, with Dominic Tavella. So, Dom, let's start out. We talked about the stock market on the open, but we really have to spend a little time talking about the bond market, because the bond market's supposed to be a safe haven, and it will be again. But with interest rates going up, with Treasury yields rising rapidly than anyone anticipated, let me just rattle off these numbers I get weekly from J.P. Morgan. On the U.S. aggregate index, this is fixed income. The U.S. aggregate income year to date is down 10.5%. U.S. corporates are down 13.89%. 13, that's stock market losses. The municipal 10-year, on average is down 9.33%. And the high yield sector is also down 9.31%. So we prepare clients and tell them when interest rates go up, bond values could go down, but they're not supposed to go down, stock market numbers down. These are stock market losses.
Crushed. Crushed. And one of the lines we keep hearing, there's no place to hide. This is what they're talking about, Mike.
Right.
And traditionally, I don't want to get too wonky, but we're talking about a 60-40 portfolio where 60% of your portfolio is in stocks and 40% of the portfolio is in interest-bearing bonds. And it's that portion of the portfolio that should be giving us a little cushion, should be giving us a little protection. And we count on that. We count on that cushioning the volatility when we get these crazy days, weeks, months, years. That side of the portfolio, and you spot on, Mike, that side of the portfolio, in some cases, it actually hurt us more than the stock side of the portfolio.
Oh, yeah.
So it's been a brutal year.
And you know, when normally we, and you and I talk to a lot of portfolio managers on the fixed income and equity side, and when we talk to a fixed income manager, they always love to say when they're anticipating a bad year, well, we're not going to get much capital gains or appreciation. We'll get our dividends. You know, we'll be flat. We'll get our dividends. You know, the dividends. You know, it's like putting a Band-Aid on the Titanic now. The dividends aren't, they're not helping.
So I look at that kind of a good news, bad news story, mm-hmm. right? Because the dividend will cushion some of the downward pressure. In other words, we'll recoup some of those losses via the dividend, the interest that those bonds are paying us. I think the value added, and you need to a lot of patience on this one, is typically for most of our clients, that dividend on a monthly basis is getting reinvested, right? Mm-hmm. So we're literally buying more shares every single month, shares that are depressed maybe by 10% or more. So we're buying them at a discount, and we're buying shares that will, in addition, pay us more interest, more dividends. So it's a compounding effect at discounted prices. We're not going to see a lot of benefit of that in the short run, but maybe 12, 18 months out, you're going to go, oh, this thing popped. It's the ability to buy shares at a very discounted price. So there is some benefit to this, but boy, it's tough to look at. It's tough to live through.
And as you said on the open, you know, our job is to be the voice of reason, provide some context. So here we go. Unlike 2008, where we had the financial crisis and we had a crisis of liquidity and the crisis of will municipalities not be able to pay their bills? Will corporations, you know, run out of their lines of credit? That's not the issue now.
No.
The fundamentals of the corporate bond market and the municipal bond market is fine, right? We don't hear headlines about Sacramento going out of business or the city of Chicago not being able to meet their payroll. We don't hear any of that. They're financially fine.
And we can argue even better than fine. Mm-hmm. Corporate balance sheets have never been healthier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure they have at some point historically, but they're as rock solid as they've been in a very, very long time. And municipalities, some counties and cities and around the country really were in dire straits with their budgets, right? A large measure of that money came down from Washington through a lot of these relief programs. Sales tax have recovered very nicely. Property taxes never went down, right, Mike? Your property taxes didn't go down. Mine didn't go down. So the balance sheet for municipalities, for the most part, is very healthy. They've been able to fund some of their liabilities, including pension liabilities. So you're dealing with a municipal bond market that is pretty healthy, a corporate bond market that's pretty healthy. This is just a seesaw effect of interest rates going higher, bond values going lower.
Yes. But, and here's the but, it's not so much that interest rates are going higher. It's that the quote unquote experts completely miscalculated how far, how fast will they go higher. And I think that's where the bond market has cratered, because in January, Dominic, the experts were telling us, you know, and then we share that with our clients, that maybe they'll raise interest rates two or three times in 2022, a quarter of a point each time. Now up to seven times. Some portfolio houses are predicting 10 times. They're raising rates 0.5% at a time, where some members of the Fed think they should raise it 0.75% at a time. So I agree with you. It's not that the fact, yes, it's because interest rates are going up, but what's compounding that is no one really knows for sure the pace and the velocity that these rates are going to continue at.
Yeah, Mike. So the only thing I'm going to quibble with your comment, and then I'll agree with the other 99%, is you use the word expert. So the reality is many of people in our industry, many people in government, as you said, we're looking at 2 to 3 rate increases. They did not deem inflation as being that big a problem. Inflation was going to be transitory. How many times did we discuss that? And we had some terrific guests on our show right here that said that just was not accurate. That statement was not accurate.
Right.
And in hindsight, that statement was not accurate. They were way off base. But the question I have is, if they were that far off base about predicting inflation not being a problem, how far are they off base this time predicting that it will be a problem? And that's literally the crux of it all is, tell me what inflation is going to do the balance of this year. I'll tell you exactly what the Fed's going to do. I'll tell you exactly what the market's going to do. And we don't know. The honest answer is we don't know.
So I was talking to Milton Konigsberg this morning, the founder of one of our firms. He's been investing money literally for over 60 years. He's an avid Fed watcher. When he and I worked together, he would look at the money supply literally weekly. So he knows what he's talking about when it comes to the Fed. And for the first time, I heard someone say, is there a question of confidence in the Fed chair in navigating us towards this time period? You know, and I was a big fan of Jerome Powell, and I still am for the most part, because I thought the way he handled the beginning of the pandemic was perfect. The way he threw money, you know, at the problem, unlimited liquidity, low interest rates. But now the bill has come due, and that's why we're raising interest rates. And you question, you know, will he be able to navigate this part of the process?
So look, anytime, I'm trying definitively not to be judgmental here, right? But more explaining, and again, trying to be the voice of reason. You know, they're all looking at a picture, and you could almost argue we're trying to look at this picture through a cloud. And only as some of the cloud goes by the wayside, we can see a better picture, a clearer picture, and a better understanding of the facts that we have in front of us. So it's hard now to look at this and say 6 months ago, what were they looking at? Mm-hmm. Right. And again, Mike, you and I, and a lot of people that we listen to, and I want to say very smart people, kind of saw the writing on the wall that they were underestimating inflation. Right. Mm-hmm. Today, there's a great many people that go, yeah, they were wrong and they're going to be wrong the rest of the year. I'm inclined not to take that other extreme as well. What I do have confidence in, and maybe I'm just trying to hang my hat on something, is that when the Fed did realize that they were behind the curve, they had no problems pivoting and changing the outlook and the strategy they were going to employ. So they went from raising rates 2-3 times this year, 0.25%, to raising interest rates maybe 6-7 times and 0.5%, and maybe more, right? So I don't know that rationale today is written in stone by the Fed. And I actually take confidence in that they're going to look at this situation month by month, quarter by quarter. And if they need to adapt, i.e. tighten more, that would be terrible, but they'll do it. And if they go, no, we've tightened enough, let's see what happens, I think they'll do that as well. So I think the fact that they've been responsive and willing to acknowledge that maybe some of their past calls haven't been spot on, hope gives me some hope in the future that as the circumstances change, they'll change as well.
Yeah, I think they've demonstrated that they're able to change. My complaint is that they were slow to acknowledge it. That, I mean, you know, they had to see a headline of $5 a gallon of gas for them to say, all right, maybe we've been a little slow to the party. That's all.
Again, Mike, I could not agree with you more. There were circumstances that were beyond their control. The war in Ukraine is a perfect example, and that affected energy prices particularly. But energy prices were way high before the war in Ukraine, right? We have an additional issue of COVID in China. That China is closing down entire cities, that affects the supply chain and our ability to get product, and how that affects inflation. But prices were high before this issue in China. So they could have certainly been a little bit more aware, a little bit more in tune. And honestly, I think listening to some people out there that live and breathe this stuff every day, meaning they work, they run companies. Sometimes they sit in their ivory towers and not quite in tune with what's going on in the real world.
Yeah, the old boots on the ground, Dom.
It helps, right? You and I get most of our really firsthand knowledge from our own clients, right, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to pivot slightly, we're still going to talk about bonds, but we're going to talk about I-bonds. I don't know about you, Dominic, but since yesterday, I got at least 8 to 10 phone calls about people wanting to buy I-bonds, which are inflation-pegged bonds, which are now going to pay 9.62%. I'll repeat that. 9.62% over the next 6 months. So now, again, there's a lot.
That's an annualized return, though, right?
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
Correct. So there's a lot to be said for 9.62%, but typically that's the headline. And as always, Dominic, the devil's in the details.
Devil, which we will both, I think, argue that these are good things, right? Yep. And I'm going to let you go through the explanation process. But they always have strings. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So number one, you know, per Social Security number, you can only buy $10,000 of these bonds. That's first off. Second off, and again, I agree with you. We're not trying to talk anyone out of it. We just have to understand how these things
work. Or in it. Right.
Right. That 9.62% is only for 6 months. So as you said earlier, the inflation number is going to come out tomorrow. And if the Fed is finally getting a handle on inflation, then in 6 months from now, that interest rate, hopefully, quite honestly, that rate will be a little lower because that 9.62% is tied to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. So there's that.
Mike, I want you to continue, but I just want to stress that's an annualized return. So over right. 6 months, you're going to get half of that number in your account if you actually buy one of these bonds.
Right.
Which is terrific, right? We both would take that in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. You know, I believe you have to hold on to them for 1 year, which is
correct.
Fine. And if you get rid of them before 5 years, this is a weird rule, they take back the last 3 months of the interest.
It will say they penalize you 1/4's worth of interest.
Right. And the other part of it is, as we say in Brooklyn, it ain't hard to buy. It ain't easy to buy. I mean, I went to the website today for a client. It's a little difficult to navigate, to be perfectly honest with you. And you can't go to a Chase or a Citi anymore, I understand. You got to buy it online.
I'm going to let you call that one, Mike, but I think you need to buy them direct.
I think you do. Actually, the website's called T-Bills Direct. So it is a little bit of a process, and you know, I've been having conversations all day with clients about it, but I think our advice tonight, I think you'll agree, is just don't get hung up on that crazy high interest rate, because as I said, there's some devils in those details.
Yeah, just emphasizing some of the points you make, you know, the maximum amount you can buy is $10,000, but you can buy $10,000 in your name, $10,000 in your spouse's name, $10,000 for each of your children. And then, you know, think about holding on to them for 5 years. I know this front number is exciting, right? But even if you averaged out over the 5 years, 3%, right? Because maybe inflation 5 years from now is not going to be as high as it is today, that I think that's a pretty good rate for relatively no risk investment, right? But just think of this as liquid money that you're parking somewhere and kind of forgetting about it. And in the end, you may not get a crazy return on it over that the entire period of time. But given having money just sitting in the bank earning nothing, it's not a bad alternative.
No, absolutely. Neither one of us is trying to talk anyone out of it. But, you know, I think our job is to break through the noise of the headline. And the headline, which I have, you know, here, basically says, hold on. I apologize. Not very professional of me. Should have been ready for this, Dom. You set me up. The headline says, nearly risk-free I-bonds to deliver a record 9.6% interest for the next 6 months. Isn't that very enticing?
It's enticing. It's a headline that obviously gives you a very limited picture. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, I'm sorry repeating it, but I think both you and I agree that as a bank alternative, this is not a bad thing for some of your dollars, but it's not quite the headline, and it's not quite as easy as just walking into the bank and buying a CD, right? You buy a CD today, they are still historically low, and they give you no inflation protection. So not a bad place for some of your assets.
Not at all. You know, and on that note, Dominic, I know you want to talk about the inflation number that's coming out tomorrow. You know, the I in these I bonds, I believe, does stand for inflation, inflation protected securities. So why don't we take a quick break? And then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the inflation number that we're going to get, how that affects mortgage rates, you know, the home buying market and the market overall.
Yeah, and look, at the end of the day, we're going to oversimplify it now. We'll dig more into it when we come back. But it's really the story of what's going on today, why things are moving the way they are today. And I think if our clients understand that, at the very least, they'll be able to digest some of this volatility a little easier.
Right. It's a two-part story. Inflation today, recession tomorrow. So we'll get into that when we get back.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
When you're thinking about where to park your cash, for over 30 years in the business, I've been a fan of funds like the Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. It's managed for cash and designed so the interest income you receive is free from federal taxes. And who doesn't love paying less taxes?
Mike, generating interest that's free from federal taxes is appealing, but I've been in this business for a long time, and people love the potential for more income on their hard-earned cash.
Sorry, Dom, but the beauty of the funds is paying less taxes on cash.
No, my friend, it's the potential for more income.
Mm-mm, less taxes.
More income.
Less taxes.
More income.
Less for taxes. Your cash. Ask your advisor about the Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund.
Less taxes.
Or find out more at dcmadvisors.com.
Well, Dom, one thing I know we agree on, it's not what you earn.
It's what you keep.
Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. Symbol LETAX. The tax.
Before investing, you should carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information is in the prospectus, a copy of which may be obtained by calling 800-441-7031. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. There is no guarantee that this or any investing strategy will be successful. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. The fund is distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC, member FINRA. The fund may invest in municipal securities, the interest on which may be subject to federal alternative minimum tax. After the fund buys a security, the IRS may determine that a bond issued as tax-exempt should in fact be taxable. There is no affiliation between DCM Advisors, LLC, and Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC. DCM Advisors and Ultimus Fund Distributors are not affiliated with Labenthal Financial Services, Inc., or Labenthal Global Advisors, LLC.
You are listening to the Labenthal Report. If you're listening to the show live, join in on our discussion with questions or comments at 1-866-472-5790. Again, that's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to contact at Labenthal.com. Now, back to the Labenthal Report.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman, back with Dominic Tavella. So, Dom, you know, I ended the first segment by saying, you know, inflation today, recession tomorrow. We talked about the Fed, and really a lot of the hyperventilating that's happening right now is, can the Feds raise interest rates at a pace and velocity that will not tip the economy into a recession? And the truth is, we're not going to know that for months. You know, we may not know that for a year. So we'll get into the recession part a little later. But why don't you, for the benefit of our audience, talk about the inflation part now and talk about what's going to happen tomorrow morning at 8:30.
So I apologize ahead of time for the dumb analogy, but think of inflation as a speeding car. And it's going down the parkway and it's going at an excessive speed. And that's prices of goods and services getting higher and higher and higher and more unaffordable by the average person out there. So the Federal Reserve decided at some point recently to go, hey, maybe we need to start tapping the brakes on the economy, slow it down a little bit, because if we don't slow it down, this car is going to crash into a tree and create a mess, right? So the Federal Reserve lowers the speed of the car, lowers the growth rate of the economy by raising interest rates. There obviously are people that said they should have started this a long time ago, but we are here today, and this is what the Federal Reserve is trying to do. The great unknown, and anybody that tells you they do know is just being silly, right, is how hard does the Fed have to step on the brake? How high do they have to raise interest rates before the car starts to slow down and maybe slow down to the perfect 55 miles an hour, the soft landing that you hear a lot of these experts talk about? Can the Federal Reserve slow the car down to have it coast in at a safe speed? And boy, if somebody could tell me the answer to the question, will inflation slow down the latter part of this year, that will allow the Fed not to have to raise interest rates excessively, then we could have that pretty soft landing that we all would like. If the Federal Reserve is in a position where they feel like they have to slam the brakes, and Mike, you and I lived the early 80s when mortgage rates were 15-18%. That was the Federal Reserve slamming the brakes on the economy, raising interest rates so high that the economy came to a dead stop. That's a recession. So we're going to get a good number tomorrow to give us good in the context of being able to get a clearer picture. I don't know if it's going to be a good number in terms of economic output and inflationary cost. But we hope it's a good number. More important, a good number, bad number, it's really about, does this finally start to peak and finally start to come down? And that, I think, takes a lot of stress off the economy, the Fed, the stock market, bond yields, bond rates, and everything else that goes along with it.
Thank you for that explanation. That was perfect. And really, it's kind of the scenario, Dom, where bad news is good and good news is bad. Because under normal circumstances, we don't want to slow down the economy, right? We want the economy to continue to grow. But to your point, we can't slow it down to the point where it's stopping or contracting. And that's what creates the recession. Now, if people are wondering, well, why do you raise interest rates to slow down the economy? Well, it's the cost of doing business gets more expensive. And you mentioned it earlier, you know, the early 80s. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't remember any of that at all. But I
never forget. My first mortgage was over 15%, Mike. I will never forget that. I might forget my own name. I might forget what I ate for lunch, but I will not forget 15-point-something% in 1982. So we don't want to frighten anybody. We don't see that happening. But no. That literally is how Volcker put the brakes on the economy.
Right. But that's a great example. Because the housing market now, I mean, you hear stories all the time. Everyone's got a story how there are people, you know, people put a house up for sale and they sell it in 10 minutes and there's a bidding war and there's 10 people banging on your door and you sell it X above asking price. So when mortgage rates start to go up, the average home buyer's budget is greatly affected by that. So when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates and mortgage rates start to go up.
And they are higher today, right, Mike? That's already started the process.
Exactly. Significantly higher. So now if you were anticipating buying a $500,000 home because you were going to get a 3% mortgage rate, now if mortgage rates are 4.5, now your budget's not a $500,000, maybe it's 450, right? So everyone's got to do that math individually, but that's what slowing down the economy is all about.
And let's take that your analogy one step further, Mike. So now you buy that house and, hey, I was going to renovate the bathrooms. I was going to do a new kitchen. I was going to put a deck on. Maybe you don't have the money to do that, or you postpone it, which is what we're hearing a lot about right now with our own clients. Like, I don't need to do that project. I'll do it tomorrow. Well, when you don't do that project, all of a sudden the cost of lumber is not being used, the cost of porcelain and the cost of tiles and labor, the plumber that comes in, the electrician that comes in, all that doesn't get used. And when you stop the demand, the prices come down.
Right, because the price of labor comes down. Right, because right now, that's the other thing, where I said good news is bad and bad news is good. We had a great jobs number on Friday, and the market didn't like that because it didn't indicate that things are slowing down yet, that the cost of labor is still too high.
Yeah, Mike. So again, glass half full. We want the jobs. We want people to go to work. We want people to make a living and pay their bills and buy houses. But doing it at a very incrementally slow growth rate. And I'll give you one stat that just literally got lost in the shuffle during that whole thing on Friday. Wages went up by year over year by 5%, which is a really good number for labor. But that number was lower than what some analysts were expecting. And that might be the first inkling that, hey, we might be starting to top out on wages. And that's wages are a key factor in the inflation number.
And you said this, so let's pivot now. Let's look out, 9-12 months. And we've talked about this in the past. Just because interest rates are going up, just because the 10-year briefly was higher than the 30-year treasury, which is called an inverted yield curve, which is indicative maybe of a recession, just because all these things are in place doesn't mean we have to have a recession. So describe for the benefit of our audience and clients what the media means and what the Fed means when they talk about a soft landing.
So back to my car analogy. The Fed is committed to having inflation substantially lower by year end, but they don't want, if they can help it, they don't want to push the economy into a recession. That helps nobody. It doesn't help the average worker out there. It doesn't help the average family in America. So the key is this incremental, deliberate rising of interest rates so that things become more expensive. Demand goes lower. Expensive demand going lower means that the cost of goods and services starts to decline. And that's what we mean about inflation rolling over, where the last number was over 8% increase year over year inflation. Tomorrow's may not be such a pretty number, but if next month it's 7%, and the month after that it's 6%, then as inflation starts to come down, the Federal Reserve doesn't have to put their foot on the brake as hard as they're doing, can ease off a little bit, let the economy coast, and hopefully we get to, that 3 would be optimistic, but 3% growth rate in the economy, inflation maybe at 3-4% about the end of this year. That would be the soft landing that everybody hopes for. But again, this is a hard thing to do. This is not as easy as dialing up or dialing down, the speed in a car. It's not that easy. It's not cruise control.
And the soft landing is not to topple the economy into a recession, which is two quarters in a row of negative GDP, gross domestic product, which measures basically the entirety of the whole U.S. economy.
And here's, we got a kind of a shocking number. Again, it just flew under the radar. But the first quarter of this year was actually a negative number. Now, we weren't expecting a really strong positive number. The first quarter is usually a difficult quarter because people have done shopping for Christmas and they're not spending a lot more money, and businesses are rebuilding their inventories. Economic growth in the winter usually is slower. So there's a lot of reasons why the first quarter usually is not a strong quarter. But we actually had a negative, I think 1.4%, negative quarter. So theoretically, if this quarter ends up being negative, Mike, and this is one of your favorite points, I want to let you jump on it. But if this quarter that we're living and breathing through right now ends up being negative, technically, we're in a recession.
Right. Right. And you know, and it's funny, we were in a recession 2 years ago and no one even knew it.
No one knew it until we were out of it.
Yeah, it was like 10 minutes. We were in a surround. It wasn't 10 minutes, but I'm exaggerating.
It was two quarters,
obviously.
But that was COVID. That was the economy shut down. People were homebound. They couldn't go out. They couldn't go out to dinner. They couldn't shop. So yeah, what a shock. The economy contracted, went negative. And two quarters of that, boom, we had a recession. As soon as the economy started to open up, the recession is over. A lot of experts have said, Mike, even if we did go into a recession, and very few people think we get one this year, but more likely next, that it would be that kind of recession. It would be very quick, very mild, and we'd come out of it. That's a positive in my book.
You know, and you just touched on it briefly, and I'm glad you did. You know, when the market went down 2 years ago, and we talked about this, I think, two shows ago, the last show with Mary Lasante, we could tie that to the pandemic. When the market got clobbered in 08, we could tie it to the financial crisis. Obviously, 2000 was a tech bubble tied into 9/11. And now we look at this period of time. And again, we'd love to label things. We'd love to put a reason on things. And you know, at the moment, Dom, we're just in this period in the economy, which is normal, where we have expansion and contraction. And I think the frustrating part for investors is they cannot tie the decline, they can't blame it on anything other than a normal economic cycle, which I think just doesn't resonate with many people.
Well, for a lot of people, it's kind of hard to really understand why we're going through this, right? But I don't want to oversimplify this, Mike, but there were some really critical mistakes that were made. And I even hate to use the word mistake because, you know, when you make decisions, you're making those decisions based on what you know. You don't have a crystal ball that can predict the future. So we know at this point, on one side of the fence, it was monetary policy where the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates and kept them low for a really long time when they could have, should have started raising interest rates much more gently, softly, maybe as recently as a year ago. So we know the Fed Reserve could have been a little bit more proactive in not allowing us to get to this point. But we also know both this administration and the prior administration, they threw $5 trillion, real dollars, in the economy. They gave, and I'm not discounting, there were people out there that really needed it. There were people that made the difference of being able to put food on the table, people that needed to be able to pay their rent. I get it. Many small businesses that would have been out of business. I get it. But they dropped $5 trillion of cash into the economy. And when people and businesses got all that money, if luck would have it, they didn't need it. We recovered much quicker than people thought. Hey, you have all this cash, you're going to go out there and spend it. And that's what they did. And when they spend it, they put all this pressure on products that weren't there because the pipeline hadn't freed up yet. And that put all this upward pressure on prices. So way too much money coming in from Washington, way too low and accommodative interest rate policies by the Fed created an environment where there was way too much money chasing way, way too few products.
I'm glad you said that because we've been blaming a lot of this on fiscal policy, which is the Fed, but it was also federal policy, right?
And that's the monetary policy. That's right. The fiscal policy. Excuse me.
And I don't want to sound indifferent or not compassionate. I agree with everything you said. And a lot of people were rescued and they should have been rescued. They deserve to be rescued. None of us did anything to deserve what we went through. But the last bailout that the federal government did, you could argue, was the one that created the labor shortage, that created the supply chain shortage, because that's the one that was kind of 50-50. Did we really need to throw all that money out there again?
Yeah, and Mike, one of my favorite statistics, and I think for the most part it still holds true, was the amount of money literally sitting in bank accounts, both from individuals, consumers, and corporations. We literally are talking about $4 to $5 trillion of liquid cash sitting in bank accounts that is not spent. Even to this day, the majority of it is not spent. So when it's literally sitting at a bonfire, you got a fire hose full of gasoline and you're pouring gasoline on that fire. You're trying to put it out, but you're pouring gasoline. And again, I understand the motive was to help a lot of people that needed that help. And I'm not here to judge anybody. If you needed the help, God bless. That's what the money was for. That's what government is supposed to do, is aid people at the time of need. But certainly we can look back and go, did you need to put that much gasoline on the bonfire? Maybe a little less or a little bit more carefully might have made more sense. So again, the Fed on one side, Washington on the other, both administrations, I'm not here to throw stones, but $5 trillion of extra spending coming down from Washington, that's added to our national debt, which needs to get paid back. And it's added a lot of gasoline to this fire, the economy, that is going to have to drain out before we see inflation significantly go lower.
Okay, so good, another good segue, because 6 months ago, 7 months ago, 8 months ago, when we were talking about 2022, what were we talking about? That the possibility that income taxes were going to go up, right? It wasn't even a possibility. It was all likelihood. No one even talks about income taxes going up at all anymore. We're really barreling quickly towards the midterm elections, which we know there's a high possibility that one or both houses will turn back to the Republicans, which will make raising taxes even more difficult. But to your point then, when is this bill ever going to get paid?
So the cynical part of my thinking is that it's never going to get paid, right? So the only way that you actually pay it back is you pay it back with cheaper dollars, meaning inflation. If the dollar is worth less, your buying power of that dollar is worth less. Then when you go pay back this IOU, you're paying it with a discounted dollar. So maybe some of this being cynical is not necessarily an accident. But what does scare me, a lot of the things in front of me, Michael, I'm worried about, but I wouldn't use the word scared. The one that does scare me is right now we owe $30 trillion on our national debt. A 1% increase in interest rates is $30 billion increase in interest payments. And then literally to put an exclamation point on it, $300 billion, is half the national amount of money that we spend on defense. Mm-hmm. So we literally are looking at taking half the defense budget, and I'm not sure we're going to get it from there, but in terms of context, half of the amount of money we spend on defense would be needed to pay the extra interest if interest rates go up by 1%. So that's a frightening concept to me.
Well, Dominic, to your point, it's almost a certainty they're going up 2%.
We think at least, you know, so the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates twice so far, but only by 0.75%, 0.25% the first time, 0.5% the next time. I think 3 more at 0.5% each are written in stone. And then I see that pause that I'm hoping for, maybe timing with the November election being right down the road, and maybe interest rates starting to flow roll over. But yeah, Mike, the 10-year Treasury hit 3%, and I think we started the year somewhere around half that number. Mm-hmm. So yeah, interest rates are definitely going higher. It's hard to believe that they won't. Very hard to believe.
No, I think. Look, I think if they don't go higher, that actually will cause the stock market to go down.
Yeah, the only way they're not going higher, Mike, is a recession.
Right.
Right. The Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates if the economy is in a recession. They want to make that then that recession as mild as possible. So they won't be looking to the economy already be dead stop and going negative. They don't want to push that car off the cliff. So they'll stop their interest rate cycle until the economy recovers. So I don't see that happening, at least the balance of this year.
So we have a few minutes left. Let's try to put some good news on this thing before we go, you know, and let's look at, you know, good news being good news. And the good news is the economy is still strong. The labor, you know, the labor market, the jobless market is low. People are employed. People can get a job if they want one. Wages are going up. People have money to spend. The consumer is still resilient. If we didn't have supply chain shortages, you know, people would be doing, as you said, renovations still and using all that cash. So, Dom, it's not all gloom and doom. The reason it's we're having this conversation is because we have a good economy.
It's not. And look, you know, we joke about the bobbleheads on TV and the headline risk, but the consumer, 70% of the economy is literally spending. Consumer spending, last reported number was up by 2.7%. Historically, it goes up by about 2%. So it's actually increasing. We talked about wages going up. We talk about the unemployment number being historically low. We talked about job openings being historically high. So there's a lot of data there that says, hey, if the consumer can, will continue spending, and it likely they will, the economy may slow down. And again, I think it will, but not come to a dead stop, and we won't go into a recession. And I don't see the consumer spending. Everybody we speak to, they've been locked up. They've been in jail for 2 years. They want out, and they want to be able to go back to enjoying life a little bit. And you joked many times before, Mike, try to get a reservation in a restaurant, try to get a reservation in a hotel, try to get an airline ticket. Not easy.
Yeah. And you know, airline tickets is a good example because, you know, I've flown a lot since the beginning of the year so far, you know, to different trips. And airline tickets are expensive. I mean, they're not cheap right now. And that's a combination of obviously higher fuel costs, but it's also an indication of demand.
Yeah, those seats are filled, Mike.
Yeah.
For the most part, they're filled. So the airlines can charge what they think they can get away with because there's not an extra seat, right? Or very few. We're in the midst of earnings season right now. And on the average, we've had about 70% of companies report better than expected earnings, an average beat by about 10%. Now, that's not an extraordinarily high number on either one of those two stats, but it shows the companies are making money. And a lot of our contemporaries go, oh, all that data is looking backwards and doom and gloom going forward. Maybe. But the leading economic indicators really don't show that. Not yet.
Right. And it's interesting when the market hit all-time highs and the price earnings ratios were getting a little distorted, meaning the price of stocks versus the money they were making, money was flowing into the market. Now that we've had some compression and the price earning ratio, when we get back to what they call fair value.
Very fair value in this case.
No one wants to own these companies now.
Nobody wants to own them, right? And, you know, maybe we're down to the last couple of minutes, so I'll try to make this point quick. It does, even after 35 years in the business, everybody talks about all the names, right? The Apples and the Googles and go, oh my God, this is a great company. This is a great company. But when you get an opportunity to buy some of these really terrific companies at really discounted prices, we won't mention any names specifically, but XYZ and it's off 20% since the beginning of the year. And you go, I get to buy that really good business, that really good company at a 20% discount. And I'll wait till it recovers and then I'll buy it. So
I'll wait till it's full value.
I'll buy high and sell low.
It's crazy.
And so look, it takes courage, it takes conviction, and it takes a really long timeline view of your holdings. But we've always been of the mindset, if you could buy good quality names, good quality companies at discounted prices, a little patience, a little fortitude, you'll look back and be grateful that you did.
Your patience and fortitude to make sure your allocation is correct.
Absolutely.
And Dom, I can't leave without also mentioning that New York City is the center of the baseball universe. The Yankees and Mets, for the first time in history, are the first two teams, National League and American League, to get to 20 wins first.
Somebody would argue that in itself is a sign that the world as we know it will no longer exist. But I'm grateful and happy right now. There, as a New York sports fan, I've had very little to be happy about lately. So I will take what little I can get and enjoy it for as long as it lasts. And look, you have to look at the glass half full. And if that's what puts a smile on my face these days, I'll take it.
So on that note, we are out of time. We're going to be off next week. I'm traveling, but we will be back on May 24th with a new show. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody, and be safe.
Thanks for tuning in to the Labenthal Report. Dominic Tavella and Michael Hartzman will be back for our next program, airing next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a great week.